time for hour number two of the Bible study. I'm Chuck Rathert. It is the Ask the Pastor Hour. Our numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727 if you'd like to join us with a question or a comment. You're always welcome to come in, change the subject if you like. We have lots of conversation on different things, and you're always welcome to come in and talk about something else if you like. Our numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We say good morning and welcome to our good friend, Dr. Victor Belton. He is pastor at Peace Lutheran Church in Decatur, Georgia. We regularly have kept Dr. Belton and his congregation, his community, in our prayers because they have had suffered through a long water shortage. We had a lot of snow up here, Dr. Belton, I guess. Does it snow in Decatur, Georgia ever?
We get snow once every 2 or 3 years.
Oh. So you're not going to get your water from the snow, then, I guess.
No, I'm afraid not. It takes a foot of snow just to make an inch of water, right?
Yep, I think that is correct. And so
we need a lot of
snow. Yeah, well, don't pray for that.
No.
So last time we did talk, though, you indicated that there was some positive movement there in the aquifers and things are improving. Does that continue?
Yes, it's getting, it's not back up to, you love this term, full winter pool, but it's better than it was. So we've had some precipitation and some is coming. So we're grateful for that.
I have just a stack of information here that, and I'm not quite sure where to go first here, so I guess I'll just begin at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Things that I'd like to discuss with you. Here is a story that says CBS has picked up the quote-unquote arranged marriage television series. There's a picture here of a bride, you know, the little figurines, you know, they put on the top of the cake.
Yes.
And there's the bride on there, but there are four men standing on top of the cake and little figurines along with the bride. So apparently she is going to do her choosing on a reality television series. The story says CBS is treading into potentially controversial territory again. The network has ordered a new series from the producers of Top Chef that puts lovelorn singles into arranged marriages. The show introduces four adults, age approximately 25 to 45, who are anxious to get married but have been unsuccessful in their search for a mate. Their friends and family select a spouse for them, and the newly paired couple exchange marital vows. The series follows their marriages. The rest of the details for the project, whose early working title is Arranged Marriage, are being kept under wraps. The series is from Jane Lipsitz and Dan Cutforth of Magical Elves, which launched Project Runway on Bravo and produces the network's Top Chef. It is the second series greenlighted by CBS's new reality chief, Jennifer Bresnan, following the recent order for Block Party, a competition among neighboring families. The series order for marriage shows CBS is not shying away from reality projects that might draw a few pointed editorials in the wake of the network's previous envelope-pushing social experiment, the fall 2000 series Kid Nation. The marriage series comes on the heels of CBS's success with traditional scripted fare this past fall, led by the hit new procedural program titled The Mentalist. Still, marriage will inevitably draw comparisons to another arranged marriage reality show, Fox Network's infamous Married by America. The short-lived 2003 series drew fire from conservative groups, and one bachelor party scene containing pixelated nudity resulted in the FCC slapping Fox stations with $1.18 million in fines. CBS's project contains some key differences from that 2003 Fox series. In the program Married, couples were paired by viewers voting from home and then sequestered in a hotel to learn more about each other. CBS's project presents itself as a documentary series about finding true love, a show that extends the Eastern tradition of an arranged marriage where friends and family select the mate, into Western tradition. Another difference is that on Married, despite the pundit outcry, nobody on the show actually ended up getting hitched. On CBS, reality TV couples will really tie the knot. So, What does the Bible have to say about marriage, Pastor, and does it fit with this experiment?
You know, I believe that the Bible points to Adam and Eve, one man, one woman, the man leaving father and mother, forsaking all else, and taking unto himself this one wife for the purpose of being family and procreation and order in society. The enemy's working the enemy. That would be Satan, the devil, however you want to do it. And even if you don't want to be religious about it, you could say the enemy of the American way of life, the enemy of the fabric, moral fabric of America, is working hard at deconstructing family. And it's understandable, because family is the basic unit of fellowship and relationship on the planet. If family can be deconstructed and family becomes whatever it is we want it to be, and marriage becomes whatever it is that we want it to be, then whoever's arranging those rules can reconstruct the morality of our entire country, the morality of our entire society, the morality of the church even. So this is a critically important thing that's happening in our society, this deconstruction of our long-held moral / Christian / American view of world and morality. It's a dangerous thing.
Okay, so the title of the program is Arranged Marriage. Now, my Old Testament knowledge is kind of thin here. Was it Abraham that sent out a servant to find a wife for Isaac?
Surely. So arranged marriages are not new.
No, arranged marriages are not new. And I guess when Mary was betrothed to Joseph, that was a marriage that, at least on the surface, as far as the families were concerned, that was arranged. The dads got together there and worked it out that Joseph and Mary would be married. It got complicated later when the incarnation took place. But that was an arranged marriage, wasn't it?
Yes, surely it was.
So
and still, in various parts of the world, there are, as it were, arranged marriages where in our Sudanese community, where the Vicar Bafo Dang is pastor, I've participated in a number of those marriages where had they still been in Sudan, those things would have been arranged. But since they're here, but the parents are still back in Sudan. The parents had to get together in Sudan in order to arrange and agree upon the marriage being valid in the United States.
So an arranged marriage is not, that's not sin.
I would think an arranged marriage is in no way problematic. In fact, honor your father and mother.
Okay.
In as much
so
as
this TV series is looking better to me all the time.
Yeah. What's good for you? So yeah, I would see there's, I don't think the scriptures point us to there being a problem with arranged marriages.
Now, it doesn't say here whether the, I don't know what we call them, contestants. It doesn't say here whether or not they get money to participate in this show.
Mm-hmm.
Let's assume that they get something other than just a, you know, potential marriage. If you enter into the context of this television program, you know, arranged marriages don't involve television programs.
Mm-hmm.
Do you cross a line when you do this in order for CBS television to get a television show out of it?
I think the line gets crossed whenever it occurs that we're doing a thing that deconstructs what we've always known and biblically held as the rule of morality, the rule of law, as it were, regarding marriage. And so dowries are exchanged even in some cultures. The Sudanese culture, for example, the family of the male will give a few dozen cows or something to the family of the female in a kind of dowry. So I don't even think the exchange is problematic. It's the deconstruction, I think, of the value of family
that's problematic.
All right, let's put that on hold here for a second. Take a telephone call. Our numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Phil, you're on the Bible study.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Acts chapter 16, 1 through 5, we have Paul here, and he picks up Timothy, and Timothy takes him on as a disciple, and he had a Greek father and a Jewish mother, so he takes him and he circumcises him. And then it says a little bit further down that he brought with him the decisions that they made in Jerusalem. And some of those decisions, if you read a few chapters back, was that you don't have to be circumcised to be saved. So I'm reading this, and I'm wondering, did Paul do this so that the Jewish people there could get past that and he could go ahead and witness to them? I mean, is it something like that, or is there something else here, Thomas?
All right, we'll talk about it. Thanks for the call.
That's a great question. I think that that his reading is right. I think that Paul does this so that we can get down to the issue of Jesus without being encumbered by Timothy's how shall we say, physical appearance. Is he or is he not? And so Paul does it. That solves the issue. He didn't do it because it was a law. In keeping with the law, however, he did it, I think, more as a way of resolving the issue so that the gospel could be proclaimed well.
And some of us are wondering why the compromise. The Judaizers had been following Paul around, claiming that you must be circumcised, you must be circumcised. If you want to be a Christian, that's fine. You want to follow Jesus, that's fine. But you must be circumcised because we have the law of Moses. And that argument is refuted. That's what produces the council.
That whole Jerusalem council, yes.
Just to address that. So you say to yourself, what? Paul? Our hero? He wimped out here in this case, or what?
No, Paul became expeditious for the cause of the gospel. 1 Corinthians 8 kind of points us to a place. 8:11 through 13, and that whole chapter though talks about something as simple as eating meat, and if eating meat sacrificed to an idol wounds a brother's conscience, then Paul says, you know, I'll never eat meat again, because by doing that I'll destroy my brother because of his weak conscience and his lack of knowledge. And so if Paul is willing to give up meat for the sake of the conscience of the weaker brother, certainly he'd be willing then to circumcise Timothy as well for the cause of the conscience of the weaker brother, so that he will not cause him to fall. I think that's the same scenario.
So in this case, do you think that we should be commending Timothy for being willing to undergo a great amount of personal pain and sacrifice here?
I think we would highly commend Timothy, and I'm gonna be kind of pejorative, but isn't it true now that if you have some Christians are just so weak in their faith, if it's overcast outside, we won't go around the corner. We won't leave the house to get in our car to drive down the street to go to church, because I might get wet. It's overcast outside, or it's snowing outside, or it's inconvenient, or it interrupts the ball game. You know, and so this kind of self-sacrifice for the sake and the cause of the gospel is a thing that we do well to get back to. I know, I suspect that many pastors suffer through because they know and understand a thing and have an impression from God about what's right in a situation. And after that, and we express that, and the individual says, well, I'd really rather not do it. I'd really rather not sacrifice in that way. And I'd say, yeah, Timothy, because he follows the leading of his mentor, the leading of the guy that's discipling him, is to be held in high honor. And it's a higher honor than many of us in the church today get, because we believe that that's just his opinion, and I get to have an opinion too.
All right, let's go back to the arranged marriage series. I got one more question I want to ask you here about this. We are in the television age, and so the Bible doesn't have anything to say about television. There weren't any televisions when the Bible was written.
Mm-hmm.
But we're in that age now, so we have an arranged marriage television reality show. And the families are going to, they're going to pick the spouse for somebody in the family, and then they're going to get married. They're actually going to get married. I don't know if they're going to do this with a justice of the peace, or they're going to bring in a pastor, what they're going to do. But the marriage is going to be a legal marriage. And then they're going to follow this couple around to see how it plays out. I tend to suspect that if it's all hearts and flowers, that's not going to make for a very successful television show.
Exactly.
So I tend to suspect that we're going to maybe see some arguing or some discord along the way, and then we'll all tune in next week to see what happens to the couple. When I tune in, Pastor, I'm setting aside the question of the arranged marriage. I'm setting aside the question of what these people are doing as they get married. I'm asking about me.
Mm-hmm.
When I tune in to watch this, is that a sin?
I wouldn't necessarily place it in the category of sin. It's a poor stewardship decision of your time and of your energy, which God has given, but I would not raise it to the level of something that's going to keep you from entering into the kingdom of God.
That's that kind of voyeur stuff, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
I guess, in a way, which just, I don't think I can point to a chapter and verse where I say, well, you know, here, see, you're breaking this biblical admonition or this commandment, but it just feels wrong to me. There's something about it that just seems wrong.
Whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely.
It's my favorite verse.
You know, and so from that vantage point, again, not sin. Jesus died and solved the sin problem for all those who have faith in him. So let's get beyond the sin talk. Let's get to the whether or not it edifies and whether or not it builds the kingdom of God and whether or not it increases and enhances my capacity for speaking a word about who Jesus is and how Jesus is that will save someone else. Because Jesus solved the sin thing. So for all who have faith in Christ, it's not going to be a problem. However, we will be much diminished in our walk with him by such a poor use of our time and our energy, and such a poor use of the technology as well. Did you ever watch this show called Kid Nation?
No.
No, neither did I. I just didn't even, it just came and disappeared.
I'm very unhip when it comes to what's going on in television. Which either makes me really square or very bright. One of the two, I'm not sure which it is.
Well, it could make you a good steward of your time.
All right, here's another story that I want to take up with you. This comes from Fox News. It was in the news yesterday. The headline is a quote from the doctor, "Take fat kids away from parents." This is coming out of Australia, so all you American folks, you don't have to get too nervous just yet. But the story says children could be taken away from their parents if they become too fat under a controversial proposal by an Australian doctor. With 1 in 4 children in Australia overweight or obese, Dr. Shirley Alexander of the Children's Hospital at Westmead wants parents to be disciplined in what she calls extreme cases when their child or children become too overweight. Under the proposal, child protection agencies would be called in to seize a child when parents repeatedly fail to address diet problems. Alexander says, "We argue that in a sufficiently extreme case, notification of child protection services may be an appropriate professional response. In one case, welfare authorities were forced to intervene when a 4-year-old girl stood 3.5 feet tall and weighed about 88 pounds. The girl watched TV for 6 hours a day and had tantrums when denied food. Alexander said despite the efforts of health workers, a family-focused program failed to stop or reverse the child's weight gain. She said child protection authorities were notified and the child was put on a diet and physical activity program that had her losing weight. So what do you think, Dr. Belton? If your kids are too fat, should the state be able to take them away from you?
Again, it's a deconstruction. I mean, you want to talk about stewardship today, don't you, Chuck?
That's the thing. Seems the way it's assembled itself.
Yeah, it's a steward question, isn't it? Children don't belong to us, in properly understood, in terms of our doctrine and what we believe about God. They're gifts to us, and a parent that misuses and does not steward that gift of promise and that gift of life that God has set in that midst well is going to have an interesting conversation with the God who created that child and that body. But at the same time, it is not the government's position to legislate that. It takes it again. It moves it out of the place that God intended it to be. Now, it could be that the child would lose weight if taken away from his or her parents. But what are the side issues around that? Do they also remove the opportunity for a parent to be a blessing? Do they also remove the opportunity for parents to touch? Do they also remove the parental authority that's given the right and obligation by God to raise children?
Do you think it is child abuse if, in this case, we have a little girl who apparently has tantrums? She wants food, and if she doesn't get it, she has tantrums. She probably should be disciplined. I guess she's not being disciplined. Is it child abuse if parents allow their children to become grossly obese?
I think it is abusive. Sure. Spare the rod, spoil the child. And so children will have tantrums. One of the symptoms of the illness of our society, isn't it, is that we think children are supposed to receive everything that they want when they want it. And if they don't receive it, then somehow the parent is at fault. Every once in a while, no is a well-spoken word. You can't have that. You can't do that. That's not going to be good for you. Every once in a while, the answer no is a good thing. You know what I think child abuse is? And this is really going to go out there. But child abuse is to have 4 children, 5 children already, and then by way of in vitro fertilization, have 6 more. That's child abuse.
Eight more, right. Yeah. All right, let's take a pause right here. You're listening to the Bible Study. It's the Ask the Pastor Hour with Dr. Victor Belton. We'll be back after this short break.
All right, call it our attempt to simplify your life. Maybe it'll work for you, maybe it won't, but here's the deal. We're hoping that you can utilize this phone number to reach anyone at AM 850 KFUO. Yes, one number to remember, and we think it's pretty easy. 888-4-KFUO-AM. You can remember our call letters, you're halfway there. It's 888-4-KFUO-AM.
The St. Louis Art Museum announces Family Sundays. Make a good impression. A program of art projects and tours for families each Sunday in February from 1 to 4 p.m. Learn the art of printmaking. There's a different activity every week. It's a wonderful way for the whole family to spend an afternoon together, having fun and learning about the collection at the St. Louis Art Museum. Visit slam.org for the quarterly programs and events guides.
Are humans the only creatures who can teach? Find out next on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moment's host, Ian Taylor.
Researchers in England have, for the first time, identified an example of true human-like teaching methods in the animal world. The definition of teaching goes beyond simple monkey see, monkey do. First, the teacher must show the student how to accomplish a certain task, doing it less efficiently than they would normally. Next, the student must learn the task faster than it would without the teacher. Finally, to be true teaching, there must be a student-teacher feedback. They found that the small ant on England's southern coast meets these criteria perfectly. In their experiments, they placed a sugar solution about 6 inches from the ant's nest, and they videotaped what happens next. After an ant discovered the sugary treat, it returned to the nest to get a friend. The teacher ant would then lead its student to the sugar, going 4 times more slowly than it normally would. During the lesson, the student would periodically stop and turn around as if to get its bearings. Feedback between the student and the teacher took place when the student would tap the teacher with her antennae to keep her moving. God is, of course, the ultimate teacher, who gives both the ability to teach and to learn whenever it is needed. The greatest truth he teaches is the truth of salvation by grace through faith in Jesus Christ, his Son.
For a free copy of our Creation Resource Catalog, visit our website at creationmoments.com or call us toll-free at 1-800-42-BIBLE. That's 1-800-422-4253. And be sure to join us next time for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
You want your children to earn good grades. Shouldn't you expect the same from your school? St. Louis Metro Lutheran Schools have earned straight A's, affordability, academics, athletics, and accessible teachers dedicated to your child's success. All A's, plus a caring Christian learning environment for children of all ages. St. Louis Metro Lutheran Schools are also convenient with 41 area locations. To see for yourself how area Lutheran schools are making the grade, join us for our open house at any Lutheran school Sunday, February 8th from 1 to 3 p.m. That's Sunday, February 8th from 1 to 3 p.m. at any Lutheran school. For a complete list of schools, more information, or to learn about financial assistance available, visit us online at metrolutheranschools.org. That's metrolutheranschools.org.
So what's on your mind? What you would like to ask the pastor? Our numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The Reverend Dr. Victor Belton is with us here today. He is pastor at Peace Lutheran Church in Decatur, Georgia, which is a suburb of Atlanta, I believe. Is that a correct description, Pastor?
Yes, sir. It's the closest suburb east of Atlanta.
East of Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about the state and parents, overweight children. Usually when we get into a dialogue like this, we start talking about parents and their responsibilities. You were saying, you know, sometimes just saying no is a well-applied word. But as you, for example, survey your own congregation, mm-hmm. and the American family is in a mess. The one man, one woman for life model is the exception, not the rule these days. So many people are either single parents or they're on their second, maybe third marriage, and the family situation is very complicated. And maybe some of these platitudes that we offer about how parents ought to parent and how they ought to raise their children is just not relevant, because there are so many other pressing issues from family dysfunction that talking about whether or not the kid's eating too much is way down the priority list. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes. Yes.
What's your experience as you survey the American family?
We have a right, a responsibility, a privilege from God to raise our children in ways that make them contributors to society at large and the world. And in this day and age, we can't even just think about the United States of America. We have to think about our children being citizens of the entire planet. That takes commitment from a father and a mother and a school system and a business community and a church community,
all working together in neighborhood, in community, for the benefit and blessing of that seed that God's placed among us. And it's an interesting thing that you would ask this question today. One of the things we did yesterday in worship was that I called all of the children forward and looked them in the eyes. I blessed them. I talked to them about what my expectations are, what our church family's expectations are for them. I said to them, you are not to be involved in the confusion everyone else is involved in just because they're doing it.
Wow, that's pretty bold stuff you're talking about there.
It's the church's task. It's our task to help and encourage parents as they raise their children. Knelt them down, prayed for them, laid hands on them, blessed them. And now these young people, if they do what the young people before them did, because this is not a first thing.
Let the little children come unto me and forbid them not.
Surely. Every year before school starts, one of the things, the weekend before school starts, I call all the children up. I bless them as they start the new year. All of the educators in our church, I call up. I bless them as they start the new year. And it almost slipped one year. And the kid called me on it and said, Pastor, aren't you going to bless us this year?
Ooh.
I mean, they're looking for acceptance and blessing and someone to have expectations for them and models. My wife and I celebrated my bride, my only bride, celebrated 30 years in August.
God bless you.
And had a through a wonderful party, had a nice time of just celebrating life and love and marriage and the grace of God. It, wonderful opportunities. I think those are the kinds of things that undergird family in our society.
All right, one more children story here. This one from the other side of the world, over in London from the Sunday Times, written by Sarah Kate Templeton. She is the health editor for the Times. She says, according to novelist Jenny Colgan, go on, guess how many children Jonathan Parrott has. Couples who have more than two children are being irresponsible by creating an unbearable burden on the environment, the government's green advisor has warned. Jonathan Parrott, who chairs the government's Sustainable Development Commission, says curbing population growth through contraception and abortion must be at least at the heart of policies to fight global warming. He says political leaders and green campaigners should stop dodging the issue of environmental harm caused by an expanding population. A report by the commission to be published next month will say that governments must reduce population growth through better family planning. Porritt says, I am unapologetic about asking people to connect up their own responsibility for their total environmental footprint and how they decide to procreate, and how many children they think are appropriate. I think we will work our way towards a position that says that having more than two children is irresponsible. It is the ghost at the table. If we have all these big issues that everybody is looking at, and then you don't really hear anyone say the P word, which is population. Two children, and that's all. Anything more than that, then you're not a very good citizen of the planet, to use your language there, Pastor. What do you think about Jonathan Porritt's perspective?
Yeah, I think be fruitful, fill the earth, multiply and subdue it. The earth is not going to fall apart because there are eight children as opposed to two children as opposed to four children in a family. The earth's going to fall apart because we don't steward our nuclear capability well. The earth's going to fall apart because world leaders won't talk and speak of peace. The world's going to fall apart because even though there's enough food to feed everybody on the planet, there'll be some green party individual that'll say, but you can't grow wheat there because there's some endangered species living on the land. Now that's kind of hard, isn't it? that was a piece of bait for somebody who's listening. But really, the planet will not fall apart because there are too many people. The planet will fall apart because those of us who should not be selfishly hoarding the benefits and blessings of this planet will not share what we have.
The thing that I don't quite understand is why is it that the third child in the family is perceived as a consumer, but not a producer?
Yes. That's a great point.
And if you have eight kids and they're productive and they help produce food for the rest of us, we would miss them if they weren't here, it seems to me.
We would absolutely miss. You know, we don't even want to talk about, we don't even want to let our minds go to what, Father, the number of contributing, wise, scientific, the number of gifted people that never hit the planet because of the way that we made our decisions around abortion. We don't even want to let our brains go there.
Okay, now I'm going to change the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Open up your Bible there to Judges chapter 3.
Okay.
This is what we talked about in the 10 o'clock hour today with Pastor Kurt Taylor, but there is a point here that I really wanted to explore with you.
Mm-hmm.
We just honored Dr. Martin Luther King a few weeks ago on his national holiday.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We just elected an African-American president, and mm-hmm. we have pretty much reviewed, I think, completely the magnitude of the distance that has been covered from the time when African Americans were bought and sold in this country
mm-hmm.
to the time when an African American now sits at the White House.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In chapter 3 of Judges, it says, beginning of verse 7, "The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of Cushan-Rishathaim,
mm-hmm.
king of Mesopotamia. And the people of Israel served Cushan-Rishathaim 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
I took this up with Pastor Taylor. I took a lot from his answer, but I wanted to raise this question with you as well. The language, he sold them into the hand of Cushan-Rishathaim, that is the Lord selling Israel, his people, into the hand of the king of Mesopotamia. How does that strike you?
Yeah, it has to be just, and it has to be righteous, because everything that the Lord does, and so, there. It has to be just. The anger of the Lord. We go back and we think the Lord thy God is a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the parents on the children to the third and fourth generation. Huh. And he only sold them for 8 years? From that vantage point, that's grace, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's grace. They didn't have to go through generations. The Lord gets angry? God, that seems out of character, doesn't it?
It does, yes.
That God would get angry. God wants us all for himself. And when he doesn't have us all for himself, he'll let us be sold into the hand of Cushan in Mesopotamia. He'll let us have who we want to have for president, Saul. He'll let us have who we want to lead and guide us. And they will not do it well. They will persecute. They'll cause all kinds of confusion. To the end that once again the children of Israel, the people of God, cry unto the Lord so that he then can show himself by raising up a deliverer. That's the whole purpose, isn't it? For God allowing them to be sold into the hands of Kushan, that he might raise up a deliverer.
But you know, I was watching a cable news program here a couple weeks ago, and I came into the middle of it, so I didn't really get to see it unfold. But the people who were discussing on the program were taking a look at the question of gay marriage, and so one side of the argument was that gay marriage was wrong, that it was immoral, and the reason that it was immoral is because it is declared to be such in the Word God, in the Scriptures. And then the gay marriage proponent came back and said, well, certainly you can find that in there, but you can also find in the Scriptures support for the institution of slavery. So his point was that if you're going to go with the Bible, then you better have slavery. That's what I took from it. How would you respond if you were sitting in the panel and heard that point made? How would you respond to that?
I've heard that point a number of times, and I had a nice little canned response to it, but I haven't heard it in a while now. One cannot. It seems to me the comparison breaks down. The whole piece about sexuality does not take any people hostage. That issue doesn't require injustice against another, an entire class of individuals and people, as does slavery, in the way that we practiced it in the early formative years of these United States. And so it's a comparison of apples and oranges. Practiced slavery in these United States in our early years the way that the Bible practiced slavery, I think we'd all perhaps want to be slaves. Look at how the children of Israel came out of their slavery in Egypt. 20 acres, a mule, gold, silver, appointments. That's not slavery the way that we understand it.
So, in verse 8 here in chapter 3 of Judges, where it says, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of Cushan-Rishathaim. You said he allowed them to be sold. But that's not what this text says here. He sold them.
He sold them. They're his property. They belong to him.
I would think that for an African-American listening to us, that would cause them to recoil. They're his property.
That I belong to a loving father.
You don't think of... You have children, don't you?
Surely.
They're not your property, are they?
One boy. No, but he belongs to me. And he knows he belongs to me. He understands that. And he wouldn't want to belong to another, I wouldn't think. Because he understands that after the selling, after I've done things, perhaps, that are less than good with him, that it would not have been out of a desire to see him destroyed, but it would still have been out of a desire to have him blessed.
You know, I'm not in a very good position here to make the case here, because I don't move in these circles. I'm thinking of Pastor John Schmidtke, who pastors at Bethlehem Lutheran Church here in St. Louis. He has a large African-American component in his membership. I would think that if Pastor Schmidtke found himself reading from Judges 3, verses 7 and following here, that he might really get the attention of some of the folks that are gathered in his church when he starts talking about the Lord selling the children of Israel into the hand of the king of Mesopotamia. But, having said all that, is it necessary to walk that walk and walk through what you're describing there in order to get a real good handle on what it means to buy back, to redeem?
I do believe so. I think we do have a African American would have a better understanding of what it is to be purchased back. And yet every Christian should at a level have that sense, since we were all at one point alienated from God. And what God has had to do since we sold ourselves into slavery to the enemy is send his son Jesus to purchase us back from all of our wages. And again, we are God's property. He owns us. It's a man giving a daughter away in marriage. You know, it's a gentleman in the early English sense of having a debt, and in order to pay the debt, one indentures his family to an individual until the debt is paid, and then once the debt is paid, the family then returns. And so I don't think it's selling in the sense of give me $5 and now you can have this kid. It's more selling in the sense of here's my daughter, you can have her in marriage, but she's still my daughter. Here's my family, you can take them for the debt, but they're still my family. And so I don't think it's the sense of we let it go, the thing that we sell, and we no longer own it. So as in a car transaction, for example, I sell you my little Toyota and we sign the deed. And so now you own my Toyota and I no longer have any right to it.
Well, this is a difficult concept to grasp, I think,
mm-hmm.
although I'm following along with you here. There is another side of this coin when it comes to thinking of people as property.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that in this country, we have evolved culturally to a point where a woman believes that the unborn child in her womb is her property.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if she decides to discard it as she would an old pair of shoes, she's perfectly within her right to do that because it is her property. And in that sense, God does not view us as property.
No. He does. His property.
His property.
we're still his property. And I think the anger of the Lord gets kindled, and we see that playing out in our nation, when we misuse his property. When we're poor stewards, you want to talk about stewardship today? When we're poor stewards of all that God has given and done for us and in us.
So what would you say to me, particularly if I were an African American and had a sensitivity to this that I don't, as a
mm-hmm.
non-African American have, but I'm trying to cover the distance here.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to me if I were to tell you that I'm troubled by the notion that a human being cannot own another human being as property, that's not good and that's not right. But God can own human beings as property, and that seems inconsistent to me somehow. What would you say?
I'd just point out God's character. The first of all, God's creator. And the guy that makes the pot owns the pot until he does something with it that dispenses. So God's creator. And if you have a problem with the creator, it would be because the creator has some defect. The creator is not going to do something with you as the pot that he created that's going to be noble. And I point to the fact that our Father, that would be God, always only does things with us that are noble and loving and kind. He only does things with us that are beautiful. He only does things in us and through us that are loving and encourage other people. And so being owned by that one who's created us is a privilege and an honor. Being owned by the world that would buy and sell, that would abuse and misuse, is a problem. And so don't confuse being owned by a creator who loves and respects and regards with being owned by a world that hates and disregards and abuses.
Okay. We have about 2 minutes left here, and I want to do a kind of a lighthearted question here.
Chuck, these times go altogether too fast.
I'm glad you feel like it's a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Very quickly here, with just about 2 minutes left, I don't know if you saw this or not, but apparently the most popular ad in the Super Bowl on Sunday was a Doritos ad, which I saw, and I have to admit was funny. About a man who had a crystal ball, and the crystal ball, which was kind of a snow globe kind of a thing, told him that free Doritos at work today. And what that meant was that he busted the front off of the Doritos machine, and then people started helping themselves to free Doritos. Is that okay, Pastor? Is that funny? Or, you know, people stealing Doritos there from the place of employment, is that really not all that funny?
You know, at that level, people stealing Doritos from the workplace, or stealing anything from the workplace, is not funny. And yet, it was a Super Bowl, and it was intended to be lighthearted.
Can stealing be comedy?
Well, it's part of the deconstruction, isn't it? And the question, I think, is there a better way to sell Doritos than to illustrate it by having someone who goes against a law and a moral value?
Well, a couple of amateurs made the commercial, and they made it for less than $2,000, and they're going to make $1 million off the deal. So, yeah, apparently stealing Doritos at work, at least if it's a Super Bowl commercial, is a very lucrative thing.
It's a lucrative thing, and it's a funny thing. But when you put it in the class that you just put it in, it further deconstructs our value system, doesn't it?
I tend to think that it does.
Yeah,
I'm trying not to think that, because I have to admit I laughed at that commercial.
I laughed at that commercial too.
Did you?
Yeah, and you know, and I didn't theologize it like you just did.
I know. I got to stop doing
Something's
that.
Wrong with me.
Oh,
obviously.
Oh, good to talk to you again, Dr. Belton.
Great speaking
with
you.
And we'll look forward to our next conversation.
All right. God bless you richly.
Pastor Dr. Victor Belton, who is pastor at Peace Lutheran Church in Decatur, Georgia, our Ask the Pastor guest here on the Bible study. We're going to continue in the book of Judges next time here on the program. Pastor Tim Ostermeyer, he of the Eternal Effervescence, he will be here to take us through chapters 4 and 5. He's pastor at Hope St. Anne. And Pastor Dan Torkelson, pastor at Zion Lutheran Church in Kleiman, Wisconsin, will be our Ask the Pastor guest next time.
Listen to Chuck Rather and guests Monday through Friday at the same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of the Bible study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.